Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, September 6th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Tim Burton's newest movie, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and we will present interviews with several of the movie's cast members. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editors Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
And Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
All right, before we get started, I want to apologize for not having an episode yesterday. I got my COVID booster and flu shot on Wednesday and was feeling a little wiped out yesterday, and I figured that today's episode, which might be supersized, could hopefully make up for skipping one. So I apologize to our listeners for that. All right, let's get into talking about this. And actually, before we talk about the sequel, I want to ask you guys about your relationship to the original Beetlejuice. I just rewatched that movie for the first time in maybe 20 years. On Thursday morning before I went to see the sequel. I was kind of blown away by it. But Brad, I want to start with you. Was that a movie that was in your rotation growing up? What's your relationship to that first film?
Yeah, I've been watching Beetlejuice since I was a kid, and I love it and cherish it. It's been a favorite for a long time. I've seen it countless times. I love Michael Keaton in it. You know, it's kind of amazing that like he's become... like the character is so well known when he has, you know, less than 20 minutes of screen time in that original movie. And it's just like a definitive Tim Burton movie. Like, it has so much of his unique style and the stuff that he would like eventually come to wear out in a certain way. But it's just pure Tim Burton through and through. It's weird. It's original. It's very funny. And it's just, yeah, it's just a fantastic movie, especially when it comes to like the practical effects and like the production design and everything. It's just such an incredible thing to look at too.
Absolutely. Jacob, what about you?
Yeah, it's my favorite Tim Burton movie, and you know, it comes very early in his career. So it's kind of, you know, I don't want to say he never topped himself, because I think I like Ed Wood maybe very, very close to as much. If you want to do some direct comparison, maybe Edward Scissorhands is like maybe the most pure, undistilled Burton movie. But Beetlejuice just feels like really special. It feels like something that came out of nowhere. There's nothing like Beetlejuice before and after. It's just a genuine mad genius got a chance to cut loose. And there's no traditional structure to it. The jokes are out of left field. The style is wholly unique, and you know, the things that people would get tired of with Tim Burton, you know, you watch them and see they're all here, like all things people will later make fun of and saying, oh, he wore this out. But for some reason, Beetlejuice still holds up, and it still feels really special. And I can be really mad at Tim Burton for the past 20-ish years, 15, 20 years of movies I haven't liked, but man, like, Beetlejuice is a lifetime pass kind of movie. And every time I rewatch it, I kind of go like, yeah, I'll forgive Sweeney Todd all over again, because this is too good.
Okay, so let's get into Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Let's start with some general thoughts about this movie, and then we'll get into some more spoilery stuff in just a couple minutes. Jacob, I know you had quite the experience with this film. I think you mentioned on a previous episode of the podcast that you flew out to New York City to do some interviews that we'll present later on. But you saw this movie under, I guess, like more unique circumstances than you traditionally do. So what did you make of this one?
Yeah, so full disclosure, I was flown to New York City for the press day. WB asked me to do it, and I agreed because I really wanted to be involved in this one closely. And yeah, so I really like Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. My reviews on slashfilm.com, I gave it a 7 out of 10. It's not great. It's not like going to, it's not going to supplant everybody's opinions of the first movie. But it is by far the most I've enjoyed a Tim Burton movie since Big Fish, which was, goodness, 2003. And I think a lot has to do with the fact that the widely publicized stuff is true. Tim Burton really does take a back to the basics approach here. There is CG, but the CG usually replicates, you know, a stop motion look. But most of this movie are people covered in latex and weird puppets and odd practical effects. Just the tangible world of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice goes a long way. The script maybe isn't as funny as the original. I think the Maitlands are missing in a big way. I like the Dietzes, but the Maitlands kind of give the off-ball when Gina Davis characters in the original, the Maitlands, they give the original such a big heart. And I think that heart is missing a smidge here. And them as POV characters not being here, I do think hurts Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. But it comes back to that style, man. I am really happy to see this world brought back to life. And I'm happy to see that's not like a CGI mess. Like the movie feels small in its scope, and that extends to its production design. And by me, that's a compliment. I like how this feels like something. It feels handmade again, and Tim Burton plus handmade is why he was special in the first place. So, I'm sure we'll get into some more misgivings about this film. But man, I just can't get over how alive the filmmaking is and the look compared to how tired things like Dumbo and Alice in Wonderland were. Like, this is Tim Burton's element. Take away the computers, and he shines.
Yeah, I 100% agree with the look of the movie and that sort of return to the glory of what made him such an interesting director to begin with. And that off-the-wall vision that he had definitely seems to be back on full display here. I have my own issues with the story that sound like they mirror a lot of yours, Jacob. But Brad, what did you think about this movie?
I agree with much of what Jacob said, except I'm not quite as not that Jacob sounds over the moon, but like I just don't like this movie as much as he does. I think it's perfectly fine. I think it's mostly amusing, not nearly as funny as the original. I feel like I only laughed out loud maybe a handful of times. If anything, it's only just like middle of the ground entertaining. I appreciate the visuals. I love the throwback to digging back into practical effects and like keeping that production design. Michael Keaton is still great and he's not overutilized. They limited his screen time. And it's, you know, I think that the biggest problem, like Jacob said, is just that without the Maitlands being at the center of the movie, you're missing some of the quaint, flavor that made the dynamic between them and the Dietzes and Beetlejuice work a lot better. And when the other half of the non-Beetlejuice story focuses on the Dietzes, who are all basically weird, it's almost like too much weird in a movie where like you need something that feels a little more normal. And even though Jenna Ortega's Astrid kind of feels like she's that grounded normal center, that she's not quite as weird as everyone else in the Dietz family, it just doesn't land as firmly. So I walked away feeling like taking 36 years to get the sequel, I wish it was something better, but I also don't think that it's terrible.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Part of me was like 36 years and this is the best that they could do. But I do think that this version of the movie is preferable to sort of the CGI slop that Tim Burton has been churning out lately, like that Jacob mentioned. So like, It could have been worse, but I don't know if that really speaks super highly of this movie as it currently exists. So
I actually think that, and we can dig into this more once we dig into spoilers. I think that the story itself suffers from a lot of the same problems that Ghostbusters Frozen Empire does, including one very similar plot point.
Interesting. Okay, all right. So let's get into spoilers right now. If you've not seen Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice yet, and you care at all about preserving your experience for that movie, turn off the podcast right now, pause it, come back. So All right, Brad, actually, I just want to follow up with you immediately before I forget that that tease that you just put there. What is that connection between Ghostbusters Afterlife that you wanted to mention?
So it feels like there's too many competing ideas here when they maybe should have focused only on one or two of them. And it doesn't do justice to certain aspects of stories that maybe would have been better if they played out to a fuller extent. You know, I feel like that there's really not much to Beetlejuice's wife in pursuit of him for revenge. As much as I appreciate the twist where Astrid's love interest, Jeremy, turns out to be a ghost, it doesn't necessarily turn to anything that like feels like it actually has any significant stakes. Like, obviously in the story, like the stakes are big, but like you don't ever really get the feeling of how significant it is because it happens so quick and it's resolved so easily. And I noticed the same issue with Ghostbusters vs. Empires. There's so many competing ideas that none of them really get enough time to cook or to really resonate. And that's especially true with that Jeremy storyline, because it's very similar to the storyline in Frozen Empire, where you have that ghost girl who strikes up a like friendship / quasi, you know, love interest with Grace McKenna's character. And it just kind of fizzles out and doesn't really reach its full potential. And so I think that there maybe should have been a little more focus here and something that like developed further into one of those ideas rather than just having all of them jumping around.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this since I saw the movie yesterday. I can't quite articulate it very well, but something about that Astrid-Jeremy relationship with that twist feels very TV to me. And maybe it's just because I know this movie was written by Alfred Goh and Miles Miller, who came from Smallville and they worked on Wednesday with Tim Burton. Or maybe it's just because Jenna Ortega is so... I forget if it was Jacob or Brad who said this, but like she's so grounded and realistic and kind of human in this movie that I just wanted her storyline to be a little bit better. I liked the stuff with her dad and the sort of reunification of her family and all of that. But like that whole subplot with the Jeremy thing, I don't know, Jacob, how did that strike you?
I'm a big fan of the Jeremy subplot. Seeing this, I did not see that twist coming. And I love how for the first half of that movie is the Dietz family very wisely saying, yeah, no Beetlejuice for us. We're gonna avoid this guy. And like even like locking up the attic and be like, yep, we're gonna play this smart. And I like that it takes this genuinely like soul-threatening event to bring Beetlejuice back into the picture. And I think that's really smart, actually. I really enjoy how after the events of the first film, even nearly 40 years later, all the characters are like, yeah, we're not gonna repeat that. We can't bring Beetlejuice back in our lives. That would be a big mistake. And the movie then finds a way to say, like, okay, we have to justify this. And the justification is, you know, a mother's love for her daughter trying to save her literal soul from damnation. So I liked it. And I like that it's a reaction to anybody who could have been said, why are they saying Beetlejuice three times again? Isn't that a dumb thing for these characters to do after the events of the first film? The answer is, yeah, but. And I think that's a good solution. And also, I have not seen Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, so I can't make... Was it Frozen Empire you said, Brad? I can never tell if that was a part. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that, so I can't make that comparison. But I will say that even with all these various plot lines kind of spiraling around, earlier I called the film small in terms of its production design, and I meant that's a compliment. And I mean that to the story, too. Even if there are a lot of threads happening, maybe some more satisfying than others, I like that it's not, oh no, Beetlejuice is threatening the world, or Beetlejuice has to suddenly rise up and be a hero to save the world. I like the stakes are similar to the first movie. It's one family under threat by one asshole ghost. And I like that in an age where everything is bigger and bigger and bigger, and everything is this massive world-shaking threat. You know, I think back to like, you know, remember how Iron Man 1 ended with a fight between two guys in robot suits? And, you know, and sometimes I kind of wish for the de-escalation of blockbusters where things can get smaller again. And Beetlejuice, you know, for all whatever threads are happening, and maybe it does have one too many subplots, I really, really like that this movie has like what, five locations, and never really feels the need to artificially inflate things to some gigantic level. I like that. You know, you guys both kind of said like, oh, 36 years later, this is it. I understand that reaction. And I think maybe I had that reaction a little bit too when I first saw it. But the more I've slept on it, the more I appreciate that it wants to be the same size and scope of the first one. It doesn't want to present grander ambitions. It wants to be comparable in its goals as the first film. And I found that refreshing in a weird way. I'm so glad that I did not feel the need to like say Beetlejuice but bigger. Instead, it's Beetlejuice but more. And I'm okay with that.
Part of me, sorry, Brett. I was just going to say, part of me really does. I'm so curious about Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, which is what this movie was supposed to be in the late 80s when they were developing a sequel. Obviously, that version never came to pass. It's like that was one of many versions of the movie over the past 30 years that they've tried to make and didn't. And I'm just so curious about what that kind of would be, because that sounds like exactly what you're saying this movie is not, Jacob, is like that sort of escalation or like... inflating the movie to be something that it isn't. I think ultimately at the end of the day, I appreciate that this movie does not try to go super big and take like a gigantic swing. But at the same time, I would be lying if I said that I'm not just like a little curious to know what that could have looked like. But Brad, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, when I say that like this is all we get after 36 years, like I didn't want a bigger Beetlejuice movie. I didn't want something that, you know, tried to like, step up and make something that, you know, was much different from the original. I appreciate that it's still small and keeps things, you know, local to the family and doesn't have this larger story. But for me, when the comedy doesn't hit as hard as the original movie, and the story just lacks a certain kind of magic, it just like, kind of taints everything about it that I do enjoy. Because like, I just walked away feeling very whelmed, like, oh, okay, well, we got a Beetlejuice sequel and this is it. You know, I wasn't expecting to be blown away or anything like that. But like, yeah, I don't know. It just, for me, it felt like the comedy especially just wasn't as sharp as the original. There was like an edginess to the original, and this feels like it lacks some of that. I definitely like the comedy that comes from like the grotesque and the weird stuff, you know, in the afterlife. There's a lot of kind of like gross out humor and, you know, signature Beetlejuice gags. But overall, I think this is something that's also stems from the lack of the Maitlands, is there's not as much comedy coming from the dynamic between like that there was between the Dietzes and the Maitlands, where they were so different and so, you know, such in contrast to each other that in itself created comedic situations. I think that's for me is where like the real disappointment lies, is that it's not enough like the original Beetlejuice to really make me feel satisfied.
Can we agree though that Michael Keaton is kind of creepy how seamless he is here, how it's the same character. It does not feel like, you know, he's nearly 40 years older, but I don't feel like a beat was missed here. It is uncanny how much he slips back in that role.
Yeah, it's really remarkable.
Sometimes it's hard for like actors to like slip back into like certain signature voices and performances, but he nails it.
Absolutely, yeah. Was there a particular moment of Beetlejuice, of Keaton's performance that stood out to you, Jacob, or were you just more sort of taken by the fact that he was able to slip back in so easily?
Okay, I'm going to tell myself a little bit here. About a year ago, somebody sent me a script for Beetlejuice, and I read it. And I was actually pretty underwhelmed by the script. And it's pretty much a script they shot with a handful of small changes. And I was kind of dreading it based on that script. And the scene in the therapy office, in the psychiatry office, where Beetlejuice plays a couple's therapist to Winona Ryder and Justin Theroux, that read so leaden on the page. But Keaton performing it, and like riffing around the lines and like finding comedic beats when he's not speaking even, made me realize, oh, holy shit, Keaton is the reason this works for me. Because I don't think the script on its own like really won me over. I was kind of like, I'm not sure about this. And it's really a testament to like Burton as a director and Keaton as an actor that they took that script and gave it this real, you know, wild life. So that's a scene where I want to point out as being like one where I kind of had to like close the PDF on the script and go, but then when I get to the movie, I'm like, oh, this is actually funny and gross and I'm enjoying this a great deal. So Beetlejuice has like what, five scenes? He has like 17 minutes of screen time. And I think that all of them are good. Like whenever he shows up, the movie immediately enters another level. And I think very wisely they choose to keep him to a minimum because a little bit of that character goes a long way. And he never wears out his welcome. So yeah, I'll go with that scene, but I also do think that every Michael Keaton scene in this movie is good.
Yeah, it's thankfully they don't fall into the get him to the Greek syndrome of bumping up Russell Brand's character from Forgetting Sarah Marshall into the main character, and in the process kind of making him more uninteresting and like removing that character's power. So Brad, were there any Beetlejuice moments that stood out to you in this one?
I agree with Jacob. Yeah, that therapy scene is great. And that's where there's some really good signature Beetlejuice gags. One thing that I was pretty impressed by and I thought worked really well is the climax with the wedding, because it offers just enough of like a difference from like what happened in the original, with, because it's a similar scenario. Obviously, Beetlejuice still wants to marry Lydia so he can get out of the afterlife. But the spin they put on it by basically combining, you know, the lip sync sequence with the wedding and doing something that was also just very like strange and visually unsettling with the selfie sequence with everyone being sucked into their phones. I feel like that had a nice combination of elements that felt very Burton-esque and, you know, took a cue from the original Beetlejuice, that it made that sequence come together pretty well.
That was the one moment where I kind of rolled my eyes a little bit. The basically them repeating the Deo kind of, oh, these people are being forced to sing a song and they're possessed and all of that. I was like, ah, that's maybe like, I wish the movie had distanced itself from that and not turned it into something that seemingly has to happen in every single Beetlejuice movie. I kind of was appreciating that the movie didn't really have too many overt wink, wink, nudge, nudge, hey, remember this Easter egg kind of thing. Like sometimes whole movies can feel that way, like Deadpool Wolverine or something. But this movie I thought did a pretty decent job of not falling into that like overly nostalgia trap. But that was one example where I was like, ah, I really wish story-wise they could have come up with something that didn't call back to that moment in the first movie in a really specific way.
Aren't you glad it's not Deo again, though? Like, they went for a completely different song, completely different tone. So I have to, I'm not saying you're incorrect, but I'm saying I disagree, because I think that Deo would have been cheap, but instead they go for MacArthur Park, which is a song that it's like the whitest, like, 70s ballad of all time. And I found it funny because it was so incredibly different. And when you hear my interview with Catherine O'Hara, very brief interview with Catherine O'Hara later on the show, she has a very funny moment where she remembers being told about the scene and saying, "We're gonna do the whole song." And yes, they do the whole song.
Yeah, I think that's why I like it more too. Is like, it's a big swing because they do the whole song, and also the vibe is totally different from the Deo scene. It just feels like it's a little more grand and romantic yet goofy at the same time. And so like that's why I enjoyed it more than just like a rehash of like another Harry Belafonte song or something like that.
Yeah. I've seen some people say that this sequel isn't really about anything. And I kind of mostly agree with that assessment, but I think there might be one small exception, which is rewatching the first movie so recently for the first time in a long time, and then seeing the sequel, the primary thing that jumped out at me that sort of cuts through both of these movies is that they are both about parenting. And I definitely did not pick up on that as a kid, especially with that, you know, obviously with that first movie. In the first film, there's this implication that the Maitlands have not been able to have children of their own. And then later in the movie, this really nice relationship develops between Barbara Maitland and Lydia, where they seem almost more mother and daughter than Lydia does with Delia, her actual stepmom. And then in the sequel, that through line continues by exploring the Lydia-Delia relationship a little bit more, and then it obviously plays out in the most overt way with that strained dynamic between Lydia and Astrid. And I was just wondering what you all thought about that strain of the movie.
I'm not sure I would go so far and say that like it's not about anything. I think if you had to pinpoint something, is there's definitely a focus on how grief can drive us into toxic relationships. It's not necessarily so prominent that it feels like it's a thematic element of the movie. It's there as part of the story. But since you have both Astrid and Lydia dealing with two people who are manipulating them and pretending to be attracted and in love with them for their own gain, I think that that's something that is pretty key there, even if it's not necessarily something that resonates on a significant emotional level in the way that the original theme of the first Beetlejuice does.
Yeah, I agree with that. What did you think, Jacob?
Brad put it really well there, but I'm going to go a hard pivot in the other direction and say a potentially controversial thing, which is a movie can be about its style. a Michael Mann movie is about its style, honestly. Like, what's a Michael Mann movie usually about? It's about its style. I feel very strong that Michael Mann's themes are a weak sauce. Style is substance in some cases. And I think that Beetlejuice 1 and Beetlejuice Beetlejuice are films about their style, where the experience of being in that world and seeing those visuals is what it's about. And I don't need to tack on deeper meaning to an artistic vision that puts that at the forefront. Now, I'm not going to say that should be for every movie. Not everyone can get away with that. Like Michael Mann and Tim Burton, I think, can get away with that at their best. And I know that they couldn't be more different, which is why I find it's a very amusing comparison. But yeah, a double feature of Miami Vice and Beetlejuice coming up. I think that makes sense to me in a weird way.
Actually, Beetlejuice was also in a toxic relationship from somebody who wanted something else from him as well. So there you go. Even stronger.
Yeah, that's true. Jacob, I don't know if I can like fully sign off on that Michael Mann take. I feel like there's his movies are about a lot of different things, but I take your larger point, and maybe just with a different example in there. Okay, so anything else that you guys wanted to touch on with Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice before we take a break and get into Jacob's interviews here?
Oh, Danny Elfman, great score again. Goes without saying, I feel like Danny Elfman delivers, you know, even in the worst movie. So it should be pointed out that Danny Elfman did do another great score for Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Oh, that score, when it kicks in over the opening credits, I mean, look, I'm a Haunted House guy. I talked about this on the show before. I love Haunted House attractions. And I hear that music, and I just think about a line outside a Haunted House and the smell of fog machines and latex and, like, cool autumn air. It's like the great fun horror score. And man, it's back. What a great score.
Excellent. All right, well, let's take a break and then we'll be right back.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Okay, Jacob, you spoke to a bunch of people for this movie. How about we start things off with your chat with Winona Ryder? Anything that you wanted to mention in terms of setup before we just get right into that?
I just want to say that for these interviews, you had 3 to 4 minutes for each person. It was very much a video-based setup. Some of the videos were published on our YouTube channel. So if you want to go check those out, you can. Some of these interviews are better than others. I'll leave it at that and let you pick which ones you enjoy.
Okay, here's Jacob's chat with Winona Ryder.
So I think one of the benefits to a sequel this long later is you can actually lean into the passage of time. So
yeah.
So... But would young Lydia seeing older Lydia in like a vacuum like be disappointed in what she sees?
Oh my God, that's a really interesting question. I think certainly I never pictured Lydia either having children or in any type of relationship. I just always thought she was just probably like in her own world as she got older, just sort of like in the attic and, you know, happy, but, you know, alone. Yeah. And so that was the big challenge was, you know, who is she now? And I, when I first read it, like she has a show, like it was hard to imagine. But I think once we got there and like, once Jenna and I bonded and once Justin came on board and you kind of remember, like I think everyone who's like as old as I am now, like we've all been in those things where you're just like, what was I thinking? You know, like in terms of the relationship I have. But I think, I don't know what young Lydia, I don't think she would ever have expected to be in front of a camera, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That was a challenge, I think.
And speaking of the passage of time, like I'm so curious because you worked with Tim Burton at the very start of his career and now you're working with him after like, before Tim Burton was a brand and now everybody, you say Tim Burton, you have these images in your heads like.
Yeah. Like,
so has he changed as a director, especially for actors?
actually, no, not at all. And that's what I find so amazing was when we did the first one, you know, I was 15. It was such a weird script. Everything was so sort of strange and it, we never felt like the studio was giving notes. Or I don't even remember meeting anyone from the studio. We were just sort of, it was kind of under the radar feeling and very sort of intimate and playful. And I think it's like so, it blows my mind how he was able to completely recreate that. And even with all of this sort of buzz or anticipation and how much people love the original, like you would think that you would be getting a lot of there, you would be feeling the pressure. And, but somehow he creates this sort of womb where you feel completely like it's like opposing ideas, but you feel complete freedom and like to try things, and you trust him. I mean, I trust him 1,000%. I know he's not going to use something that doesn't work. And at the same time, you feel safe in the best way because you know he won't, you know he has a vision. And so he had that same energy, which I think, you know, he's talked about wanting to get back to that. And he really managed to do that. It was really, really incredible. I did work with him in between, and I've known him, oh my God, I mean, I've known him since I was 15, and his energy and the way he gets inspired, like, in the moment, oh my, you know, what do you think of this? What do you, you know, like, it's infectious, and I think, yeah, he's also incredibly protective of Lydia, and I always so appreciated that so much.
Well, I'm out of time, but thank you so
much. Oh my gosh, yeah. Sorry.
Thank you so much. This is great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And here is his conversation with Justin Theroux.
So, I want to know, as somebody who's also a writer, when you see a character like this on the page, how does your writer's brain kick in to help you find the character when you're actually beginning to act?
Tim was pretty collaborative. He was like pretty great at just being like, let's find some more stuff. And he was gracious enough to let me sort of, you know, scribble in the margins a little and improvise. So, you know, we would, you know, and then we obviously sort of found elements of the character that weren't necessarily there on the page, and he let me riff. So it was great.
What's a moment where you realize that, oh, this riff is working?
I think it was a couple things, just elements of the character that were like, he was a people pleaser, he was a narcissist, and that he was was trying to encourage a codependent relationship with Lydia. I know it's maybe sounds like we're overthinking it, but there was a lot of attention paid to wanting to make sure that the relationship felt real, and that it didn't, but it was also funny, you know, so we wanted to make sure that the relationship felt like it could actually exist, you know.
Yeah, and it's interesting to talk about the trying to find that element of realism, because the characters in Beetlejuice, the living and the dead, are both heightened. There's a, I don't want to say cartoonish, it's not quite cartoonish, but there's a, it exists in a halfway point between a cartoon and live action. You talk about how you find that tone as a performer?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, all good comedies played straight, pretty much, and you let the words and the situation do a lot of the work for you. You know, I mean, Catherine O'Hara is like one of those incredible actresses that, if you took her performance and gave her different words but gave her the same intensity, it could very easily be drama. But I don't know, there's just, it's people, I'm not saying myself, but someone like her or Willem or particularly Michael Keaton, you know, they just know how to do it. You know, it's not broad, weirdly. It's pretty down the middle.
Was there a moment like, on a set like this where there's so many
fully built sets and practical creatures and monsters compared to like a lot of films I've seen recently. Was there something that caught you off guard where you said, whoa, this is like something I haven't seen before as an actor?
I had never worked, I don't think, with puppets, you know, or animatronics, and that was really fun. Like, to be able to work with, like, for example, that Beetlejuice baby was like an incredible piece of not just art, but also machinery and engineering. That caught me off guard, just how fascinated I was by that. And then just all the sort of blood and guts, you know, rubber, latex, and goo stuff was just fun because when, for example, when he rips open his sweater and that blows all over me and Lydia, it really, it requires very little acting to react to that because it's such a fun gag, you know.
Yeah. What is Michael Keaton, in terms of like your relationship on the set, like how much of it is you bouncing around, how much are you sticking to script, what is the dynamic between you two when you're
seeing? It's great, you know, I mean, I have such a reverence for that character, like so many people do, but I did not want, it's a weird combination. He's sort of like a firework that goes off when Tim says action. You don't want to get too close to it because you don't want to like, you know, block anyone's view from what he's doing, but you also have to participate with it. So he was just hilarious, you know. He's a very thoughtful actor, you know. He's not a, he really works things out ahead of time and sort of blocks it out in his head. So you don't want to, the last thing you want to do is sort of like impede the layup. You know, you want him to be able to do it.
Here's his chat with Monica Bellucci.
So in the movie, it's a very physical performance. It's driven entirely by how you're moving, how you're inhabiting the frame, as opposed to, you know, there's not a lot of dialogue. So how do you prepare for a role where you know you're not going to be saying much and you have to sell your character physically like that?
But I mean, acting, I think, is a lot about body talking as well, because the body is the instrument for an actor. And in this case, yeah, the film is very much about body language, and I felt a bit like a mime. I tried to act like a broken doll, and it was so interesting because it was another way to exist in the film. And I was very helped because I had 3 hours of makeup every day, mm-hmm. and to get into these amazing sets and to wear those beautiful costumes of Colleen Atwood. And also Tim loves to draw, so there are always drawings of characters and situations, and he likes practical effects instead of CGI. Mm-hmm. So for us, for actors, it's easier because you have real monsters to react to instead of a green screen. So you can go farther with your fantasy, your imagination.
There's definitely some clear, you know, universal monster influence in there, at least to my eye. Was there ever like a specific monster or creature where either you or Tim Burton was like, this is something we should be trying to capture? Was there like an influence like that?
But I mean, I think that in his drawings, there are so many characters. Mm-hmm. They have this kind of physicality than Dolores has. And also if we think about Corpse Bride, there is this kind of fantasy world. And what I like about his characters is that often they have childlike qualities, mm-hmm. and he knows how to create situations that are scary, shocking, unpredictable, but also very deep and emotional and funny. Because Beetlejuice, even though is a comedy, it's a dark comedy, but still a comedy, but there are deep meanings because it's about life, death, love.
Yeah. So what was the set like when you're filming the flashback sequence with you and Beetlejuice, the black and white one, because it has a very distinct vibe?
Oh, this was incredible because it was so funny. And also I had this intimate scene with Michael, and we didn't know each other. Of course, I knew the amazing actor, but he was so kind and so generous, and also was so interesting for me and beautiful to see the creative synergy between Tim and Michael through the years. Mm. And I have to say that when I saw the movie, even though I knew everything, But I was really impressed because it's incredible. I mean, when the visuals are unbelievable, and I have to say that maybe it's a bit more scary than the first Beetlejuice.
And then finally, Jacob speaks with Jenna Ortega and Catherine O'Hara paired together.
A lot of people always talk about Tim Burton as a stylized director and talk about his visuals, but I've always been curious about him as an actor's director. How does he direct his actors? How do you find your characters? What are those conversations like?
They're super, silly and loose, and yeah. He kind of doesn't put too much pressure on you, you know? He trusts the people that he works with, so he'll have all the conversations that you feel you need to have, but he does like to give space as well to let you kind of figure it out or throw out your own ideas. He's not like super strict on anything. It's just very malleable and very considerate. Also you always want to go with, you find yourself, because he creates such a world, kind of going in the direction that maybe he sees fit anyway.
Oh no, he knows what he wants, but he makes you feel like he's totally open to your ideas. And he is, he actually uses them and laughs. And if he doesn't want to use it, he'll give you a good reason, but he gets it on film. He can cut it later, he knows that. But also leading up to doing the movies, he'll talk forever about your character and where it's going and why it's funny or why it means something or, you know, what this person's going through. He's very open that way. And when you're shooting, he is extremely visual and an amazing artist, but he will never force your character, you know, to do anything that doesn't feel right to you. You know, he'll always ask, how do you feel? You know, it's just really collaborative and exciting and fun. He's very playful.
Was there a moment where you're working with these, you know, standing wild sets and these creatures and costume monsters that are actually there, which is really refreshing to see, but how the impact of performances where you're able to actually interact with all these things that are actually there?
Well, because everything was practical, you were working with, a man whose face was burned off, or, you know, Santa Claus had, you know, fallen down the chimney and, you know, been caught on fire. You know, you were seeing all of it in real time, so it was amazing.
It gives you everything you need.
It's so much better than, like, a piece of
green
tape
screen.
Green screen, piece of tape on the floor, or a tennis ball. It's just, it kind of inspires you. It's so refreshing to know what's going to happen. Oftentimes, sometimes you watch a movie back and you go, oh, that was it?
That's what I was looking at?
Was there a moment or a sequence that that truly surprised you? Was it, oh man, how this happened? How am I going to roll with this?
Soul Train sequence.
Oh, yeah.
The train station in the afterlife was unbelievable, so bizarre. The entire, all the dancers, they just killed it. It was so good.
Yeah, really cool.
I want to remember that day forever.
And the whole church and the musical number, when I first heard they were doing it, I said, the whole song? And Tim just came up with so many levels of insanity in that number. But real stuff going on too with Lydia and Astrid and us. It's just wild and great and surprising.
I'm out of time, but thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Pleasure.
Nice to meet you, Jacob.
All right, before we wrap things up, does anybody have anything else to say about Beetlejuice?
The one interview you won't hear on this podcast is I was part of a round table with Tim Burton. It was me and about 10 other journalists because he wasn't doing one-on-ones at the press day. And he was really wonderful and seemed like really excited. And you can read a bunch of these articles on the site, broken out from the conversation. Talks about everything about how he was planning to retire because he was so fed up with filmmaking, and quietly implied that Dumbo kind of broke him a little bit until he got his groove back with this movie. But my question to him was about the non-softening of Beetlejuice, about the character, how he's become a theme park walk-around character. He had an animated show. He's very mascot-y in a lot of ways. But this movie kind of reminds you, he's a dirtbag, con artist, son of a bitch. And there's no change for him. And Tim Burton talked about, and you can go read this on the site as well, where he told us, Beetlejuice's defining characteristic is he doesn't change. He's the same guy he's always been, and will never ever find growth. And I gotta say that I really admire that. I love that Beetlejuice is once again barely in his own movie. Each minute is great, and each minute is him never learning lessons, just in the most profound ways. always a villain, and there's nothing in this film where they that feels like it's built to be like, oh, he's softer and nicer now. No, still a son of a bitch. So very happy with that.
Oh, to piggyback on that, actually, one of the things that I did appreciate is that the movie does something that I'm not sure anyone was necessarily expecting, which is provides an origin for what Beetlejuice was like in when he was alive and a human, and mm-hmm. and also how he died. But unlike what George Lucas did with Star Wars prequels, and like what many you know prequels have done, it doesn't fully explain and define why Beetlejuice is the way he is. Like, we don't know why he became a bioexorcist. We don't know why he's like has this like eccentric behavior or like weird sick sense of humor or anything like that. Like, it doesn't try to explain who Beetlejuice is. It just gives us the details of like, oh, this is what he was like when he was alive, and this is how he died, without necessarily explaining too much and removing too much of that mystery about that character.
Yeah, that's a great point, because movies so often will try to dumb things down to where like one single event is responsible for a person's entire personality. And like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an instance in a movie where that really works, because I'm sure it does work sometimes, but in real life, things, you know, we're so much more complicated than that as people. And this movie takes that approach and doesn't say, hey, look, this one event is the thing that is the, you know, defining moment of this character's life, and it explains every single thing about him, like you said. So yeah, I definitely appreciated that as well.
If anything, it raises more questions, because, so wait a minute, Beetlejuice was human, so how did he become a demon?
yeah, that's true. I wonder if they're going to potentially explore some of that in a third movie, and that was the last thing that I was going to ask both of you. Are you actually interested in seeing a Beetlejuice 3? Because by all accounts, this movie is, we're recording this on Friday, this movie is supposed to open huge. It could potentially be one of the biggest movies of 2024 or something, if all goes according to Warner Brothers' plans. So, Jacob, what do you think about a potential third movie? And I guess the very ending of this movie, what did you think about that as well? Because it kind of ends with like a multiple dream sequence fake out, but doesn't necessarily set up for a third film really blatantly and obviously. So what do you make of all that?
Yeah, I know that during a roundtable, one of the journalists asked Tim Burton about the ending, and he opened his question by saying, I have a theory about what the ending means, and Tim Burton said, oh, could you explain it to me, because I don't know. I think Tim Burton was very interested in the ending being a big joke and a big gag, as opposed to actually literally meaning anything, which I think sums up a lot of the ethos for Beetlejuice, which is, you know, style, energy, gag first before anything else. But I'm not so sure. I feel like Tim Burton, in the same interview, said that he'd have to be 100 years old to make the next one, because he'd want to wait another 30 years, and that's not going to happen naturally. And also, Keaton would have to wait another, you know, 30 years, and that's not going to happen either. So they either need to make it immediately or not at all. But I think that the length of time between films is what makes this one feel like an event. So I think it may be better just to leave it be. They got this right. I think we all seem to agree that this is, you know, whether it's a minor success or a bigger success, I think we all fall, you know, on that 6 to 7 out of 10 range, which is, you know, pretty good movie. I think it would be a mistake to try to do this again. I think they made it work. Awesome. Now let's put it to bed and maybe let this character retire for good.
Brad, if this movie does well, do you think Warner Brothers will be able to have that sense of, I don't know, the sense of actually being able to accomplish that sense of restraint that Jacob said?
Will a studio be able to show restraint in the face of making more money? No, I mean, if it does very well, the box, but I'm sure they're going to want a third one. I do wonder if, like, Michael Keaton would even consider doing one if Tim Burton wasn't directing, and if Tim Burton would ever consider it if the right amount of money was there, or if the right story was lingering. I appreciate that the ending is left open-ended, where like Beetlejuice could easily come back without necessarily like it being a proper cliffhanger. You know, it's more of just like a placeholder, like, oh, well, he's technically still hanging around if we ever want to do anything with him. So just so you know. But I don't know if I would be excited. I would be curious, but yeah, I don't, because I feel like, you know, again, if this is the movie that we get after 36 years, I'm just not sure like what else, you know, can be done, or if there's any more juice left in it, as it were.
so to speak. Yeah. Yes. All right. Well, yeah, I think that's a good place to wrap things up. So you can find more about this movie at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of things in the show notes as well. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all next week.